You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for joining us. The JX starts today with a debrief where JPR reporters discuss the stories they've been covering this week, including the verdict in a Klamath Falls kidnapping trial, frustration about pesticide use on Easter Lily Farms, and the threat of a lawsuit at a fire district in Jackson County. I'm Roman Battaglia, science, environment, and politics reporter.
I'm Justin Higginbottom, public health and safety reporter.
And I'm Jane Vaughn, housing, homelessness, and education reporter.
So Justin, over the weekend, you got a verdict for Negasi Zuberi. He was accused of kidnapping and assaulting two women. What did the jury decide?
Well, guilty on all counts. So that includes kidnapping, transportation of a victim for criminal sexual activity, and possessing a firearm as a felon. And the verdict from a federal court in Medford came only after 2 weeks. We were expecting a three-week trial, but Zuberi's defense called no witnesses. Maybe that might have shortened it. And Zuberi never took the stand, although at the very end he did try. He had already waived that right, and the judge didn't let him change his mind. He thought that would just be a distraction for the jury.
Interesting. Can you remind listeners what this case was about?
Yeah, Zuberi lives in Klamath Falls, and last May he kidnapped a local woman from a bar there. We heard testimony from her at the court. And she described being beaten, tased, shackled, and sexually assaulted. And although she said that Zuberi threatened her and her family if she ever reported it, she did report it. She told local police, but nothing happened for weeks until Zuberi was arrested for kidnapping a Seattle woman and putting her through many of the same things this Klamath Falls woman described. Although in that case, the Seattle woman was locked in a cinder block cell in his garage, which she managed to escape from. And the FBI noticed similarities between these two cases and called in the local woman and charged Zuberi for both kidnapping cases. And it's gotten a lot of attention. The description of the kidnapping and assaults were very brutal, not something you would expect from rural southern Oregon. And there were also a lot of weird details, like Zuberi renting his house from the mayor. And one of the victims told police that he had a plan to kind of kidnap a group of women and impregnate them to raise an army for some unknown reason.
All right. And how long is he expected to serve?
So the kidnapping charges can carry a maximum sentence of life in federal prison. The sexual assault charge is punishable by up to 10 years, and the firearms charge carries a maximum sentence of 15 years. He's scheduled to be sentenced early next year, so we'll find out what the judge decides then.
Great. Thanks, Justin.
Roman, we're going to turn to you. You published a story about Easter Lily bulb farms in the Smith River Valley and how the excessive use of pesticides and inaction from the state has made residents angry. Why did you report on this right now?
So this is because the North Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board is currently considering these regulations to prevent these pesticides from getting into the water. So for those who don't know, Easter lilies are this Christian symbol, and they're in demand, obviously, around Easter. They're grown primarily or used to in Bermuda and Japan. But after World War II, they cut off the supply from Japan, so they grew them a lot here on the southern Oregon and northern California coast, specifically in the Smith River Plains, just north of Creston City, kind of became the center of Easter lily bulb production. And so lily bulb producers here have used a large amount of pesticides and chemicals to prevent a variety of threats to the lilies. And so the state started this surface water monitoring program back in 2002 and then discovered high levels of pesticides in the water in 2010. And that triggered this process, you know, leading up to now where they're, you know, considering a number of measures to kind of curb this.
Okay, interesting. So what kind of restrictions has the State Water Quality Control Board proposed to curb the pesticides leaching into the water?
So the first would be increasing the use of these so-called runoff management features like riparian buffers, these grassy swales, which are sort of just like dips in the ground, and then also more deliberate like retention basins to prevent this runoff and capture it. I'm also increasing the setbacks between the farmlands and water bodies. You know, the Smith River and all of its tributaries kind of run all through this area. Another thing would be pesticide management. The board in their reports say they wouldn't tell people how specifically to reduce the use of pesticides, but could do things like timing the applications based on forecasts, like preventing not spraying it when it rains, testing their irrigation water, using cover crops to prevent runoff, and kind of more closely tracking the use of their fertilizers and stuff. And then the last thing would be kind of increased monitoring of ground and surface water, including drinking wells that people use, and then requiring these producers to report the results and then let well users know, and then just kind of track the trends.
Okay. So in your story, though, it sounds like residents and environmental groups don't think that these restrictions are enough. Why not?
So mostly they're concerned because they think that the lily bulb producers shouldn't be using any pesticides at all. You know, the state says that the levels they've tested are not at unsafe levels for human drinking water, but they are at unsafe levels for aquatic life. And that's kind of been their big concern. And some concern from environmentalists is it could damage salmon populations in the river. But many residents also say that they've experienced health problems and more health problems since moving to Smith River, including skin conditions, brain fog, eye conditions, cancer, things like that. The environmental group Siskiyou Land Conservancy did a public health assessment back in 2016. They only heard back from 14% of the Smith Riverends, and they couldn't definitively link the findings to pesticides, but that report did find that a lot of the people they heard back from experienced more health issues after moving to Smith River. And so right now, the state is not considering banning pesticide use outright for these lily farms, but a lot of the residents want them to.
Okay. So what's happening next with these state regulations?
Yeah, so it's been a long process, clearly, and it's still going to take years to finish. And the state is going through the scoping process. The public feedback is going on until November 25th. And then they're going to start working on this environmental impact review on the proposed regulations to look at how they would impact the environment. That review isn't expected to finish until spring of 2026. Mm-hmm. And then there's going to be another public comment period. And then we wouldn't expect any final rules to be approved until fall of 2026. So another 2 years. And so a lot of residents have called for county supervisors to take action themselves in the interim since the state has taken so long. And they've kind of asked for it. So we'll sort of see what happens in the next couple months.
Okay, great. Thanks, Roman.
Jane, turning to you, you're up. You covered a story this week about a threat of a lawsuit against a fire district in Jackson County. First, who's threatening this lawsuit?
So we're talking about Jackson County Fire District 5, which has three fire stations in Talent, Phoenix, and unincorporated Ashland. And the person who's threatening this suit is Charles Hanley, who's the former fire chief for this district. He was fired back in August by the board of directors with cause after three allegations against him were found to be sustained. So those allegations were covering up sexual harassment, bullying, and interfering with a governmental promotion board. So they found these three allegations were sustained, fired Hanley in August. And then a week ago, last Friday, Hanley sent a letter to the district with a notice of potential legal claims. So basically saying, I'm going to file a lawsuit with these legal claims unless we can, you know, come to an agreement and figure it out. So that letter was addressed to the district's board of directors and the interim fire chief, whose name is Aaron Bustard. Interestingly, it does not include a request for compensation. He's not asking for any particular amount of money, but it is sort of a threat of a lawsuit if things can't be resolved.
And what's Hanley, the former fire chief's, argument here?
He has a long list of legal claims. So there's defamation, retaliation, breach of contract, violation of procedural due process, wrongful discharge, among others. And the notice says that the district has subjected Hanley to discriminatory and retaliatory conduct. The notice says that Hanley had a really positive impact on the district during his years there, which included the COVID-19 pandemic and the 2020 Alameda fire, which were obviously difficult times. And the notice also says that while Hanley was chief, he oversaw this investigation into allegations of misconduct by the district's firefighters, and that initial findings from an investigation substantiated some of those claims of misconduct by firefighters. So, but then the notice says that union leadership and employees disrupted the investigation and attempted to conspire with and intimidate the board of directors into removing Hanley from his position. So I'm, quoting and paraphrasing from the notice itself. I should say that Hanley declined a request for an interview through his attorney. So I'm getting all of this from the notice itself.
And how's the district responded?
They haven't really yet. I talked to the board chair, Greg Costanzo, and he said that the district's legal team is going to handle it. He declined to add very many specifics in response. He said the board of directors is trying to do the right thing. He called the notice unfortunate. And then I did also talk to the interim fire chief, Aaron Bustard, who basically just acknowledged that he got the notice, but declined to comment any further or really give any specifics again. So we'll have to wait and see what the district will do, if anything, to respond.
So let's back up for a second, because there's a A lot going on at the Jackson County Fire District 5. What other context do listeners need to know about what's happening right now?
Yeah, so just zooming out for a second, because there has been a lot going on here, and going back to earlier in the year, there had been allegations that district leadership had failed to address inappropriate workplace conduct back in, like, February. And so there were all these allegations, and then Hanley was placed on paid administrative leave in May, and then, as I said, he was fired in August. And that was because there were those three allegations against him that were found to be sustained. And there are still five other allegations against him that have yet to be investigated. At the same time, in recent months, the fire district has been struggling with a massive financial shortfall, potentially up to $3 million. They were potentially going to run out of money by the end of the year. But they recently signed an agreement, what's called an intergovernmental agreement, with a nearby fire district to help keep it afloat. That's Jackson County Fire District 3. And then they also had received another threat of a lawsuit, a very similar letter back in August from the former board chair, whose name is Vicki Perslow. And she had abruptly resigned from the board back in March, along with two other board members. So all three of them basically got up and walked out at the same meeting and had to be replaced. So there was another threat of a lawsuit, as I said, back in August, which claims that Vicki Perslow was slandered and defamed, and it's seeking at least $2 million in damages. So they have the threat of a lawsuit from August from the former board chair, and then the threat of a lawsuit from a week ago from the former fire chief, and the board has not responded to either one of those notices yet. So we'll have to see if they do. And what they say if that happens.
Cool. Thanks, Jan.
Wow. Justin, going around in our circle, you reported on new rent control policies in Humboldt County. Can you tell us about those?
Yeah, so this week, the county's Board of Supervisors voted in favor of applying these rent control measures that voters passed in 2016 to RV parks. So that measure, Measure V, only mentioned mobile home parks in the county when it passed. And it was passed because residents kept facing these rent hikes at mobile home parks, something sometimes from this new ownership that would come in as investors, buy up the parks, and then try to make basically as much of a profit as possible. And voters thought that was a problem because mobile home parks in California and Oregon can be sort of a last refuge of affordable housing. Vulnerable residents like the elderly often live there. So voters passed this law, which basically said rent hikes can't be more than inflation. And since then, according to the Board of Supervisors, the same things are happening at RV parks. They've been getting complaints from residents. Here's one resident of an RV park in the county, Shelley Horowitz, speaking at Tuesday's meeting.
We have some of the county's most vulnerable residents here in this park and others as well, who are really struggling to make ends meet and are in RVs full time because they can't afford a mobile home.
So this week, the county extended that rent control measure to include RV parks. And they argued that RV parks are close enough to mobile home communities that they can be included in the law. So any park with 10 or more spaces where residents stay for at least 9 months is now under this ordinance.
Got it. So you mentioned in the story that RV parks have also become a target for these investment firms. What's the impact of that?
Yeah, something that a supervisor actually brought up in Tuesday's meeting, and this topic's been covered around the country, is that RV parks, like mobile home communities, have been getting bought up by these investment firms. That park where Shelley Horowitz, who we just heard from, lives, was sold to a Sacramento-based company called the Boa Vita Group. And according to their website, they own 9 parks with over 1,500 spaces and have assets of around $113 million. And so the worry here is that just like with mobile home parks, investment groups will come in with the goal of maximizing returns and hike rents without a real concern for affordable housing.
So is there going to be any fallout then from this expansion of this rent control ordinance?
Most likely. Someone from that investment group I mentioned, Boa Vita, said extending the rent control measure was illegal. He said voters only passed rent control for mobile home parks and RV communities are significantly different. So if the county wants rent control for RV parks, then they should pass a new measure. Someone from a real estate industry group also spoke during the meeting and said that there will be costly litigation for the county, but the Board of Supervisors said they're prepared for that. The county's council assured them that it was legal to extend rent control to RV parks, so we'll be waiting on those lawsuits.
Great. Thanks, Justin. We're almost at the end of our fall fund drive this month. Financial support from listeners like you help us put on programs like The Debrief. You can go to our website at ijpr.org/support or call us at 888-552-6191. Thanks for listening. You can reach the newsroom with comments on our coverage and suggestions for things we should cover in the future through our news tip line, which you can find on our website at ijpr.org. You can also find this program and more on our website at jeffexchange.org or subscribe on Apple, Spotify, and all the other platforms.